Welcome to Talking Bach, a podcast all about Johann Sebastian Bach, presented by me, Madeline Easton. I am the Artistic Director of Bach Academy Australia, and it is my pleasure to welcome my dear friend and colleague, the American countertenor, Reginald Mobley, to be my guest on this podcast. Reginald has made a stellar career internationally, beginning when he first joined the English Baroque Soloists and Monteverdi Choir for our St. Matthew Passion Tour in 2016. He has since won his first Grammy nomination, and it is my extreme pleasure to be welcoming him to Australia for our, Bach Academy Australia's, first national tour, which also happens to include the first time we bring out an international soloist. I could not be more delighted that it is my friend Reginald who will be our first international soloist. Reggie Mobley, it's amazing to see your face again on screen after ages and ages and ages. It's just so lovely to see you, my friend. And thank you so much for coming on our podcast in anticipation of your debut Australian tour.
Yes, excited, really excited. It's been a long time coming. Honestly, it's been years since we've tried to get me over there, and I'm really glad that it's finally had a chance to work out. For as long as I can remember, I've always wanted to visit Australia, and there's so many just people, not just musicians, but actors and just really dear friends whom I've admired for so long who are from Australia, and I feel like it's just a little part of the world that you've been keeping away from me for too long, and now I finally get a chance to get there myself and see what's going on. And honestly, like I, you know, from the arts to just the scenic wonders to all the wonderful distilleries you have popping up there, this is a goal that I've been working toward for a very long time, and I'm really glad to have a chance to get there and share myself and what I do and see what, you know, and how I change as a person from seeing just how, you know, how much I take from being in Australia for the first time.
That's amazing. Yes, we have been trying to get you here for a very long time, and you can blame the global pandemic for that, I'm afraid. And you're quite right. There are a lot of fantastic whiskey breweries popping up all over the place. Australia is a funny place. We went through a craft beer phase, and then we went through a gin phase, and now we're getting into a whiskey phase out here in Australia.
Perfect. Just in time. Just in time.
That's right. Just in time for your arrival. And I also can't wait for Australian audiences to meet you and to hear your very special voice and to get to know you as well, because you're such an incredibly charismatic person. It's what I've always loved about you. And I was thinking back to when we first met, and I think it was, when was the first tour that you did with the Montes?
It was the Matthew Passion. So this would have been, this was spring, basically of 2016. I believe March of 2016 is when it started. Almost a decade. I
mean, almost a decade ago. My math really is terrible. I apologize.
Yeah. It'll be 9 years, actually, basically, when I get to Australia. So that's how long, almost a decade for us.
I know, that was an amazing year, wasn't it? We certainly went through a lot, you and I. We've covered so many miles together, many a hotel bar, drinking many a drink and sharing many a story. We have been through a lot. On that tour, remember, we went through the Brussels bombings. They happened the day before we got there. And I was so proud of what we did that tour. We went to the venue the next day, despite a lot of members of the ensemble feeling that they couldn't personally do that. And we gave that performance, and we got the Belgian Prime Minister there. It was live streamed on the television just to basically say, we are going to come together and we're going to sing this and perform this incredible music in solidarity, just to show we're not afraid. And this music means more to us than anything.
Yeah, it was unbelievable. You know, my first time really working in Europe and things like that happening. And of course, remember, like after the, so it was 8 of 16, I believe, that we were out in Snape Maltings the day before the Brexit vote. I mean, it was quite an insane year. And I remember being in the coach, like heading from Valencia to Pamplona, and like describing to half the bus how caucuses worked in America, preparing for our 2016 election. So that was, it was a fraught year.
It's certainly, my Lord. Yeah, that was like, that was global life-changing for so many reasons. Oh my gosh. Oh, but it's so nice that, you know, you and I have stayed such good friends and I have been able to bring you out here. And as I said, you're such a charismatic person. So I want you to tell our audiences about you. Tell us about where you started and your journey to where you are today.
Well, there's really not much to tell. I'm a pretty boring kid with a pretty boring life.
Nothing could be further from the truth, by the way.
I mean, you know, we've been around, but, you know, born and raised in Florida, Gainesville, Florida. You know, I learned to sing as a young cherub in the little kids chorus, in the gospel chorus choir there at my church in Gainesville. Loved singing, but didn't really think much of it. By my sixth grade year, I had decided to join the band. There was a friend, a boy I had a crush on, who joined the band. So I joined the band. He played trumpet, so I picked trumpet. And little did I know that the very first thing we played three songs that year. We played Kokomo, Baby Elephant Walk, and a transcription of a little Bach prelude and fugue in C. And I remember the first time we kind of stumbled through it and played the fugue. And there was something about being in the middle of a fugue for the first time in my life and recognizing and just understanding what it was just, it was an epiphany. It was life-changing. There had been nothing in my life that had prepared me for this thing that all of a sudden made so much sense and snapped so much of life into focus. And from that point forward, I was obsessed. I went to the public library. I would check out every CD I could find with Bach or Handel's name on it. And just absorbed it and didn't think much of it. But, you know, later on, I went, you know, going to high school. My high school was a magnet school, which is a focus school for drafting and architecture. I was in the drafting program. The intent was to, you know, be an architect or do something in visual arts. But my senior year, the chorus teacher heard me singing, dragged me into her room, and then made me change one of my art courses for chorus. I joined chorus my last year. And it was then that I really started falling in love with singing and falling in love with music formally. And so with a lot of help, I applied to a different school. So I had a full scholarship to an art school, to a school for art in North Carolina, but I applied to an HBCU, which is a historic Black college university in the US, Oakwood University, a college at the time. And not only did they accept my application this late in the game, but they also matched my art scholarship for music. So I went to school, to college, on a trumpet performance scholarship. I didn't touch the trumpet a single day. I didn't even bring it with me. I immediately switched to voice and started voice lessons. And then later on, when I moved back to Florida to attend the University of Florida, my professor heard me singing the top line of the barbershop quartet, you know, this weird sort of quasi-alto part. And he made me come to his office and made me sing scales up and down the piano. And then he told me that I was a countertenor, decided that I should be a countertenor. I had no idea what it was, but he did say when I came back the next week for my lesson, that's what I'll be doing for the rest of my life. And I've spent years, well over 20 years, trying to prove him wrong, and I haven't yet. So that, you know, more or less in a nutshell, that's kind of a little bit of my path to music and being a musician, being what I am today.
What an incredible journey you've had. Actually, I did read somewhere that you're a bit of a visual artist. Do you still paint and draw?
You know, I don't really get to paint much at all or do much of anything. I do sketch. I've done some graphic, you know, clip art and graphic design, some logo designs for, you know, for some friends for their ensembles and things like that. And I do, you know, for a long time, my bio would always end in me suggesting that if they cared about, you know, who I was, an artist, instead of asking for an autograph, to ask for a stick figure of Bach or something, or to ask for some sort of illustration. And so every now and then that bio pops up, and inevitably someone comes up and asks for some sort of sketch or something. And so I do a little now and then, mostly for fun. mostly, you know, kind of to waste time or kind of occupy my brain. But really, doing this, the music thing, the performance thing, I mean, it's a full-time job plus. It occupies all of my busy time and all of my free time.
There you go, Australian audiences. You've been given the chance. You've been pre-warning. Bring your sketch pads to concerts. And Reggie, my darling, that is something I very much relate to, is the a music career being more than a full-time job, because it's the admin, isn't it? That is one of the biggest things. No one warns you about. Everyone says, practice. But no one said, learn how to touch type, because that's going to save you a heck of a lot of time.
Absolutely. Enjoy emails and cover letters and endorsements and taxes. Enjoy all of these things.
But hang on a minute. There's more to you than this, you know. You're being extremely modest, because I think you may have spent a little bit of your life in Tokyo.
There's a little bit of time there. Yeah, in 2000, I was in a collegiate barbershop quartet, and we competed internationally and won. We were in the college division, in the international competition. We won the gold medal, and that put us in this kind of little group of past winners. And there was a particular quartet that was planning to do some work overseas, but their tenor didn't want to leave the US for more than 6 months. It was a year contract. And so they desperately tried to find someone to fill that position to replace this guy. A friend of mine from my quartet called me on Thursday and said, hey, send your stuff to this guy. So I did so Thursday evening. Friday afternoon, around after 5 o'clock, I remember he called and said, hey, we loved your stuff. We'd love you to join us. I thought it was a joke. I didn't know what to expect. But I said, you know what? Sure. It's Friday afternoon. I said yes. Half jokingly told my friends about it. That next Monday, I got a FedEx plane ticket. And that Thursday, I was gone. I packed up my entire life in less than six days and left, you know, my home that I've only ever known. I've only been to New York once at that point, but mostly I'd never left the South at all. And next thing you know, I'm living in Tokyo for really 2.5 years, working for Tokyo Disney and just being there. It was incredible, absolutely incredible. Yeah, I was a singer actor there. I did some moonlighting here and there and like little jazz clubs here and there and the Air Force Base outside of Tokyo near Fujisan. And that was just my life, honestly. And until I decided that I wanted to come back to the States after I actually heard a performance of Bakula Game Japan, heard Masaki performing in Shinjuku with his group. And I missed Bach. And it's like, you know what? Maybe singing Disney songs in four-part harmony might not be a lifetime career. And so I packed up and came home and went back to school. And next thing you know, I was deciding to try my time in Boston. And here I am 13 years later with a career that hardly allows me to be in the place I've chosen to live. But yeah, all of that kind of because of Japan was really kind of a turning point in my life, kind of a nexus point that changed everything.
Yeah. It's an incredibly special country. I went there for the first time last year for 2 weeks on holiday with my family, and I absolutely fell in love with it. It's so special in heart and soul and language and music and culture and geography. But what I wanted to talk about is what you just said, which is when you heard that piece of Bach, it touched something so deep inside you that it really almost physically propelled you back to the United States. Isn't it incredible how one piece of music can activate muscles in your body to physically want to make you move somewhere else? And we all know why Bach is important as a composer, but why is he so important to you?
Because of the music. I mean, it's just, there's something uncanny about this man and his music, this, you know, this irritable man who loved, you know, drinking wine and beer and having children for some strange reason. And just, you know, ultimately doing what he did because he saw himself as a servant, you know, to God and to really furthering his faith and his beliefs and his message through his music. But even more than that, there was something about him that kind of uncannily understood us. There was something about him and his music and the way he set everything that he just kind of keyed into the human condition better than anyone I've ever known. There's something that, even though it's so old, centuries old, there's something so evergreen, something so present and topical about his music and the way he sets it. And maybe it's because, coincidentally, because of who he was and what he came out of, but there's something about his music that, to me, growing up in the deep south of the U.S. in the 80s and 90s, there was something that just felt known to me, that just instinctually felt like this was what I knew. This was how life worked and behaved. And I don't know. Yeah, you're right. Like, there's just something about a piece of music that suddenly has the ability to reach you on a level that you just can't really explain. And I love that. I love that there are things about the world, even the very practical and useful world that we engage in, that we just can't really quantify or truly put words to. I mean, it to me, having that kind of practical magic in the world really keeps the world vibrant and full of color. That the fact that we just can't explain, understand anything, that life truly is bigger than all of us and full of so much untapped and understood wonder that we have yet to truly embrace, and that there's always the potential, always the time for us to wake up in the morning, you know, as a 47-year-old or even a 74-year-old, and just see something, experience something new, that it just never ends. I don't know. It's really beautiful. And that comes, you know, that comes through Bach.
I'm just sitting here listening to you in wonder, thinking you have just articulated that so brilliantly and better than I ever could. Thank you for saying all of that. But I'm also thinking, you know, you and I are exactly the same age. It's amazing that a kid in Gainesville, Florida, and a kid in the suburbs of Sydney on literally the other side of the world have both been so affected and touched by Bach's music that we are both dedicating our lives to it, pretty much. And it just goes to show the power of this music and how Bach can reach parts of you that no other composer can. And in a way that you can relate to, that, as you said, it felt known. It felt known to you, like Bach knows you. He knows you, he knows what you need. And he knows me out here in Sydney. He knows what I need on a daily basis. And what about the alto voice? Let's talk about Bach's use of the alto voice. I did a little bit of reading about this, and I sort of discovered that Bach uses the alto voice often to represent the Holy Spirit or the Holy Ghost. Do you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. There was, I can't remember where it first kind of came from, but there was this kind of idea in earlier centuries with music, especially the four voice types, that there was kind of an equivalency to the elements. The four basic voices, soprano, alto, tenor, and bass, with soprano being, you know, fire, with the bass being earth, foundation, with the tenor being water, this flowing thing that was kind of locked into the earth, and then the alto voice being air. And there's so many ways how it makes sense, because obviously the way the soprano and alto voice works together, air of course fuels fire and makes it more. I mean, there was something about that always kind of vibed with me. But then hearing how Bach kind of also granted very kind of parallel archetypes to the voices, and I guess not just Bach, but other composers from that area, particularly in Germany, did, you know, how the evangelist was usually a tenor, how the voice of Christ was always a bass or baritone, but Bach kind of using the alto voice to kind of encompass the Holy Spirit, it made so much sense. This air parallel, this spirit, this breath, this thing, this voice of comfort and consolation. Like, there's something about the alto voice that he saw as a parallel to that idea. And it's something that I absolutely agree with. You know, in so many of Bach's arias, there, in not just arias, but also in cantatas, he will often have the alto voice in concert with two other obbligato instruments. Like, thinking of the Cantata 54, Widerstehe Doch der Sünde, yeah, where you have the second violin and the first violin bringing this figure that is beautiful, and you don't quite think much of it, but then that that exact figure, that exact melody, is then brought in a third voice, which is the alto voice. And all of a sudden, there's now text. You now understand what this message has been the entire time. Like, it, you know, there's this Trinity aspect that seems to come quite often, quite a lot with the, you know, with the alto voice. I mean, even in the Passions, like, there's always, you know, two oboes and the voice, or two dacaccia, or two violins. Like, there's always this Trinity that always happens, and the alto voice always kinds of serves this role as the actual spoken voice, as the actual text comes through, where it's, you know, that's kind of the job of the Holy Spirit as a comforter, as a messenger, to kind of bring that, those, you know, to share the gifts of the Spirit, to share all these things with mankind, that kind of almost bridge between. So many little things and points kind of come together. But yeah, I absolutely think of that in the same way as Bach. And I absolutely agree that I think the alto voice has that particular role of kind of standing as the voice of constellations, the voice of the Holy Spirit, for sure.
Yeah, I think you are the right person to sing that, because your voice is so soft and beautiful and sweet. It's unlike any other alto voice I've ever heard. And I think that's why people are just fascinated by you and your voice, because it is so different. It's got a different quality to any other countertenor. And it is the most divine, comforting, enveloping, warm sound I think I've ever heard. And I think, yeah, that's part of the reason I'm so excited for Aussie audiences to hear you. The rest of the world has to, but not Australia yet. So it's a wonderful thing.
Well, likewise. I'm excited to be there to see your world, finally.
Yes, you will. Now, I've included a piece of Johann Christoph Bach in this program, his Lamento. Now, he had a terribly hard life, didn't he? And he died in awful circumstances, terribly in debt. But I want to really talk to you about this guy, because he was such an important man in J.S. Bach's life, as a kind of a sort of uncle, if you like, even though he was his first cousin once removed. But he really did mentor Bach. And the last time we talked about Johann Christoph Bach and about how he was born into a world that was recovering from the 30 Years' War, you brought up this incredible fact, which I didn't know, which was that slavery started in the United States in 1619. Which was around about the same as the end of the 30 Years' War. And we can draw parallels between your musical history and your roots of, you know, the spirituals and where your people's music comes from, and the trauma of the 30 Years' War. And we can link Johann Sebastian Bach with your land and where you come from through this.
Yeah, you absolutely, the beginning of the 30 Years' War. Yeah, I mean, it was 1618 was the beginning of the 30 Years' War, and 1619 began chattel slavery. Began, you know, the first ship reached Jamestown, here in the States, in Virginia. To me, it's just the best example of the most inherent link that exists between all, you know, with people in general. With, you think about the end of the 30 Years' War, so 1618 to 1648. And even though that was technically the end of the conflict, the repercussions of such went on for decades and decades and decades, if not longer. I mean, thinking of all the horror, all the pain, you know, the confusion of what's going on in life, of the uncertainty of will you live to see the next year? Will you see your family again? Like, you know, sickness and plague, all these things that came from this, in Europe during that time. What do you think we were doing here? I mean, enslaved Africans, my ancestors, dragged here, brought here, and torn apart, ripped apart, beat, and, you know, and tortured, and forced into this life where they were no longer people, but they were now property, often considered less valuable than actual cattle and sheep. And what we had in common with what happened in Germany in the latter half of the 17th century is to kind of cope, to kind of process the horror of reality in life. We turned to music, we turned to songs, we turned to what we could, we turned to the thing that expressed emotion, expressed the spirit. And you saw basically behind everything torn away, and seeing that no matter where you are, no matter how separate you are as a person, is by language, by ocean, by culture, by skin color, we all turn to something that helps us contextualize and process life through something like music. And not just that, but it's a thing that, to me, links those things together. You wouldn't think that there's a connection to these two events, but it absolutely is, because what both events have are us. It always comes back to the end of the day. It comes back to people. That's why music and art exists. You know, it's all about us. It's all about feelings and emotions and empathy and understanding and compassion. Like the fact that Bach and Thomas Jefferson and Ignatius Sancho, they hated, they felt sorrow and joy. They, you know, they loved. And you do as well, and so do I. And the people that come after us, our children will do the same. It's these emotions, it's these feelings, it's this unexplainable spirit that exists in every person that links us all together and reminds us. And ultimately, I think that's what, you know, this, the music of Bach, the music of JC and JS, and the music of my ancestors and yours do, is remind us of our shared connection, the fact that we are singularly a person, one race, one people, that we're only separated by arbitrary false walls that we put up ourselves. We create these boxes and prisons, but they don't naturally exist. And I think that it's so important to kind of show those links between these two contrasting styles and genres that show, no matter what, there is something in all of us and something in all of this that reminds us that we are, it makes more sense for us to open up and understand each other than to separate and keep ourselves apart. Another parallel to that, as I continue to talk more and more and more, is the fact that I'm not just pulling in music from the 21st century and comparing it with 17th century music, 1618, 1619. This music exists at the same time. So what I'm also saying is that spirituals and slave songs are also early music. It is also chronologically the exact same time as this. We can't think of it as separate. You know, as Handel and Bach were writing, so my ancestors were singing in fields and on plantations. You know, and honestly, for much longer. And I think that it shows a resilience of spirit in this music too, because long after Bach and Handel died, this music was still being created. Spirituals were still being sung. And when more people, you know, when like Dvorak and Delius encountered this music, they saw the worth of this, the fact that this was something new and created. And I don't know, it's just, to me, it suggests a resilience that existed in my ancestors and in my family, you know, even to my mother and my grandmother and to me now, that keeps us going and moving forward. But it also suggests that that strength exists in all of us if we choose to understand and claim it. And I think that's the point of who I am as a musician, as an artist, is that I'm not just an entertainer. I don't just share beautiful things and art, but I'm also a servant. I'm a servant to humanity. And it's my job to remind us of what we have that links us together. Like, I don't think music is going to fix the world completely. It's not going to feed the, you know, the hungry per se, but it does influence and encourage us to do it ourselves. And in that way, I think that's the power of music and what I do in everything that I do.
That's amazing. You are an enlightened being, Reggie, absolutely enlightened. What I was thinking then is that people like you and artists in general, I suppose I could count myself in this, if I may do so.
You should.
It is our job to spread that message of enlightenment, and we are all one race without borders, because we are living in a time where nationalism is massively on the rise again worldwide. And I have a theory about this, actually. It's like every 100 years or so, we have a world war, and it's when the memory of the last horrific war fades out of living memory, and the people who have lived it are no longer around us to remind us that it can happen again. And then it happens all over again, and it has done since the beginning of time and probably will continue. But it is art and musicians and artists of all genres which can really remind us that there is something bigger than all of us. And if we channel that, you said it so much better than I did, then we can help remind ourselves that there is something bigger than all of us. And Bach is a great way to do it, basically.
Oh my goodness, absolutely. I mean, that's who I see as leading the charge, or at least he inspires me to keep doing it for sure.
Now, you have gone one step further and created an incredible album called Because, which is a real kind of genre crossover, beautiful example of the music of your heritage that earned you a Grammy nomination, which is pretty impressive, my friend. Congratulations. Yeah, tell me a bit about the album.
Well, the album was, it was a strange kind of passion project and / Food Network challenge. I'd been approached to record an album with Alpha Classics based on a recital that I'd given with a recital partner years ago in Paris at Musée d'Orsay. And the concert was basically the music of the Black diaspora in classical music over the past 250, 300 years. And so the idea was to record that program, that recital as a program, which would have been fine. It would have been beautiful. It was, you know, it was everyone. So it wasn't just Black American composers like Florence Price and Harry Burley, but also Chevalier Saint-Georges, also Ignacio Sancho, Jose Nunez Garcia and Esteban Salas, like the Black diaspora of the entire world. However, this really annoying thing happened in 2020 that kind of put us all at pause for a while. And and I remember getting a call from the head of Alpha Classics, Didier Martin, who's a wonderful person, a really supportive person and friend. And I thought that he was calling to basically say that he was going to have to cancel the contract because we were living in an uncertain future. But instead, he doubled down. He said, hey, I'd like to actually see what happens if I partner you instead with this French jazz pianist that we associate with and record with. And I was just like, what, how is this gonna work? But I got to meet Baptiste via Zoom, of course, and we chatted and talked about what could happen, what we could do. And somehow the inspiration hit us of something I'd considered before, but had never really formalized a true thought of the fact that this music, you know, the music of African, of Black heritage, you know, spirituals and slave songs, and even the music of non-idiomatic classical composers like Florence Price and Margaret Bonds, we treat it so religiously here in the U.S. Like we typically try to keep perform these a certain way and keep it in a certain sphere. But I realize that like we've never really take things outside the box and kick the tires, you know, a bit. Like what would happen if we took these songs and melodies of, you know, of traditional spirituals and even melodies of composed songs, art songs by Black composers, and treated them the way we treat Gershwin and Kern and Porter, like jazz standards. Like what more, you know, emotional and you know, message power could be plumbed from these depths, could be excavated if we took these songs at a whole new door. And Baptiste was the perfect partner for that. For him to take these things that he didn't know as a white French jazz pianist, he'd heard a lot of these songs, but he didn't know them. And he didn't know them in the way that I do. And to hear them reinterpreted through his style was a complete and total change. And we worked together and arranged and put things together in a different way. And just, we created something new from something old. And not just that, but it's what happens when two people of completely disparate lives come together. You know, a Black American Southern boy living in Boston with a white French jazz pianist living in Paris, and coming together and finding just how much more impressive this music could be, how much more musical it could be. And I think about, you know, Dvorak and Delius and McDowell discovering this music and seeing the potential. And I feel like this is another arrival point to show just how much this potential has yet to be, you know, expressed and exhausted. And that's kind of how it all came to be. You know, I thought when we recorded it in Paris several years ago, that I was like, okay, this might, you know, they seem to like it here, they seem to like it in France, and, you know, the UK is interested and Germany's interested and blah, blah, blah. But I was afraid of how it was going to be received here in the States. Like, just yes, because I'm recording in this way music that in its original form hasn't even been widely performed. Like my favorite song on the album is Harry Burley's Jean. And I don't think there are any professional or, you know, commercial recordings of that in its original form. The same with some of the Price songs. But sorry, pencils down, you know, test over. Like, if we haven't done it yet, then it'll happen at some time, but I can't wait for that. I want to show this music how we do this now. And it's been really heartening to see such a positive reaction to what we did, this little labor of love. And I hope it goes on forever. I mean, I'm really excited to share this music with Australian audiences and see what connections they make and what they draw from this. Because obviously, this is not Europe. This is not America. This is not inherently music that was born and spread in Australia. But because the Australians are still like Americans, like Brits, like the French, are also human, are also, you know, one of us. I'm curious to see how quickly or how this music touches and reaches, perhaps in a different way. But the point is that I just want to share. I'm compelled to share this, and I'm really glad to be able to present some of this music during this tour.
I think it was a stroke of genius coming up with the idea of bringing your, you know, those spirituals to the sort of French jazz genre and see what came out of it. You must have discovered so many new aspects of the music and in that process of recording them and just working through them, you know, with Baptiste. It's this incredibly special album, and you'll be performing it in Eucaria in the beautiful Adelaide Hills, which is wine country, by the way. And in Melbourne at the stunning Recital Centre. So for those of you who want to go and hear Reggie sing, perform his album with Tony Grabowski in those two venues, now's your chance. And the rest of the tour, we will be going to Sydney, to Newcastle, to Brisbane, Melbourne, Eucaria, and Orange, and Blackheath. So all over New South Wales and three of our capital cities. And it's going to be absolutely fantastic for Australian audiences to meet you, Reggie, and get to know you. And you're going to go down an absolute treat here, I know. And I also can't wait for you to see my land and meet my people and be in a country where we have had a continuing civilization that goes back about 65,000 years. And I hope you will fall in love with it the way I have, especially when you get out west and get into the actual outback, on country, as it's called. And you will see the vast distances and you will feel the spirits out there. Honestly, there's nothing like it on the planet. And you'll smell the eucalyptus and hear the mad birds and the cicadas going bonkers in the trees. And it's like Mars out here. It's like nowhere else you've ever seen. So I'm very, very excited.
And I can't wait.
Thank you very much for giving of your time to come and talk to me today. And we will see you out here in Australia very soon.
Yes, I can't wait to give you a big hug. And I mean, I'm glad that I'm going to be there for a substantial amount of time, because I want to ingratiate myself and just dig in and just be a part of things there for a while. I'm really excited for this.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Reggie. We'll see you soon.
See you soon.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that chat with Reginald and I as we discussed our life, our music together, all the wonderful tours we've ever done, and what's to come up here in Australia. Our tour kicks off in Newcastle on Friday the 4th of April at the beautiful Christchurch Cathedral. Then we head down to Sydney on Sunday the 6th of April at 5 p.m. in the City Recital Hall. And then we are off around the country to Brisbane, Melbourne, Adelaide, to Eucaria in the Adelaide Hills, Orange, and finishing our tour, opening the Blackheath Chamber Music Festival. All details are found on our website, and we very much hope you will come along and see and hear this wonderful, wonderful man and musician with Bach Academy Australia. See you soon!